You're listening to Vatican Radio.
This is Vatican Radio. I'm Chris Ultieri. Chesterton and Eugenics, the Challenge of Our Time, is the focus of an international conference exploring this major theme of the great 20th century English journalist and cultural critic Gilbert Keith Chesterton, opening Friday, June 10th, on the island of Malta. The conference is being organized by the Chesterton Institute for Faith and Culture at Seton Hall University in New Jersey and Malta's own Life Network Foundation. The president of the Chesterton Institute at Seton Hall and editor of the Chesterton Review, Father Ian Boyd, is among the featured speakers at the event, along with his Seton Hall colleague and friend, Professor Dermot Quinn of Seton Hall's History Department. Father Boyd and Professor Quinn visited Vatican Radio ahead of the conference and spoke with us about the conference's theme, explaining in a nearly hour-long conversation with me how Chesterton's understanding of the threat of the eugenic movement was profound, far-sighted, and even prophetic.
Father Ian Boyd, I am the editor of the Chesterton Review.
My name is Professor Dermot Quinn of the Department of History of Seton Hall University.
You're in town because you're on your way to Malta for a conference, and you're talking about eugenics. Interesting word. It sounds very nice, doesn't it?
It does sound nice, and it's not nice. And I think that's probably the theme of our conference and the theme in many ways of the Chesterton Institute, to try to explore the ugly aspect of something which seems to be rather attractive. I mean, eugenics was a hugely popular movement at the beginning of the 20th century. It really dates, I think, from about 1865. In 1865, Francis Galton, who was the cousin of Charles Darwin, published an article in Macmillan magazine, and he talked about the plasticity of human beings, the possibility of creating, as it were, through genetic manipulation, better kinds of human beings. In 1883, he published a book called Influences on Human Fertility. In that book, he actually coined the term eugenics for the first time.
It's worthwhile, though, pausing over that point when you talk about genetic manipulation. In the second half of the 19th century, mm-hmm. we are talking about generation the old-fashioned way.
Absolutely.
Selective breeding.
Exactly so.
And the anthropological point is the important one, and that is treating human beings as though they were higher-order animals. That is the fundamental premise and flaw of the eugenics movement, surely.
Yeah, I think, the distinction that was made then, and the distinction which is continues to be made, is between positive and negative eugenics. Positive eugenics being, so to speak, producing better, healthier babies, and negative eugenics, the elimination of the weak, the infirm, and the otherwise unworthy of life.
Right, but it's also the Chesterton point of treating human beings as though they were dray horses.
Oh, of course. I'm not I'm not defending any kind of eugenics. At the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, this was procreation in the usual way.
Right, and the point I want to make, and a number of people have made, was that Chesterton's challenge to the eugenics movement before the First World War was a successful challenge, in the UK at least, because single-handedly, through public lectures and, of course, his writing, Chesterton stopped the eugenics legislation in England. So the legislation introduced, by the way, by a conservative government, Balfour's government, at the beginning of the 20th century, and then revived by a liberal government. It had cross-party support, Labour, Liberal, and Conservative. This Mental Deficiency Act, which was introduced then in 1913, Chesterton challenged it so effectively that practically every bad feature of the bill was removed before it was finally passed. A completely toothless bill, which in the end, all it suggested was that illegitimate children should be brought into what they call, what's the euphemism, into government care. Probably a bad measure too, but no talk about sterilization, no reference to the undefined feeble-minded. All Chesterton's points were effectively accepted by Winston Churchill, Home Secretary at the time, and an enthusiast for eugenics, and, as I say, a popular movement, a eugenics congress just before the bill had 750 delegates, and it was addressed by Balfour and Churchill and all the leading politicians of the day. Chesterton was really confronting a very powerful and entrenched establishment movement, and he did it successfully.
It was a setback, to be sure, to the movement. And the movement itself was not helped also by its enthusiastic embrace by the National Socialists in Germany.
That discredited it temporarily, anyway.
The bill that Chesterton opposed was the Feeble-Minded Control Bill.
Yes.
And that made distinctions between different types of human being.
Yes.
And that's the thing that Chesterton was just deeply offended by, as I think any Christian would be, that there are, so to speak, worthy kinds of human life and unworthy kinds of human life. So that the Feeble-Minded Control Bill, which was a private legislation or private proposed piece of legislation, made distinctions between the feeble-minded, idiots, moral imbeciles, and so
on. And always the poor, of course.
Always the poor. Those sets of distinctions, which would then be, so to speak, ratified by law, Chesterton found very offensive, as indeed did his great friend Father Vincent McNab, who was a Dominican priest and one of the great English Dominicans of the 20th century. Father McNab opposed the bill as well. As Father says, the resistance to this eugenics legislation was led by Chesterton and by Father McNab and
Quiller Couch,
as well, and indeed was successful. Now it should be said that the Mental Deficiency Act, which was passed in 1913, remained in the statute books until 1959. And the question was, it was a perfectly reasonable question that was being addressed, namely, what do we do with people who can't look after themselves? This is not an unworthy question, and it's something that has to be answered. The law has to have some sort of response to the problem of people who are incapable of looking after themselves.
But you would agree, wouldn't you, that the law, bad as it was altered immeasurably for the better by Chesterton's criticism of it.
No question about it. And just to get to Christopher's point, the eugenicist movement was associated obviously with National Socialism in the 1930s, and that in the eyes of British eugenicists certainly discredited it temporarily. I think the point of our conference in Malta is to draw attention to the fact that eugenics, although discredited in its most egregious forms, has returned, so to speak, by the back door, and we have a new eugenicism, to coin a phrase, which poses every bit as much a challenge in the first years of the 21st century.
More insidiously.
And we see that in all sorts of ways across the world.
Another point, I think, to be stressed is the prophetic. We're already making that point, I suppose. The prophetic nature of Chesterton. He said of Cobbett, lines that could be applied to Chesterton. He said of Cobbett, he saw what we see, but he saw it when it wasn't there. Chesterton saw all the, as you say, insidious developments of the eugenics movement, where now you can have a tailor-made child by manipulating the genes, he saw that danger when it wasn't there answered it. So his prophets, of course, speak to their own day, as Chesterton did most effectively, but they also speak to the future. So, and we who've lived to see what eugenics came to be within the Nazi period and what it's come to be in our own day, find that Chesterton really is speaking to us even more than he spoke to his own contemporaries.
Well, it certainly did, I'm glad we've come back round to it. The Nazi experimentation with programmatic eugenics certainly made the vocabulary arguably a less fastidious age, the first half of the 20th century, extremely unpopular. I was thinking about this. I was reading some Cicero last night, and there's a line from the Republic. Vitium autem. It is owing to our vices that we have lost the thing of our Republic and have retained only the name.
Yes, that's wonderful.
Well, we've lost the name of eugenics. But we've got the thing, haven't we?
Yes, very well said. That's indeed the problem. And really, it's the sort of thing Orwell talked about and admired Chesterton for, too. Orwell, who did his first writing in GK's Weekly, Orwell points out in Politics in the English Language that a great deal of what's wrong with the modern world is the use of euphemism, that we find... Well, of course, eugenics was an example of it, a beautiful word for an ugly thing. But we're constantly dealing with this so that things which would be rejected by any normal human being, we are put to sleep by beautiful words. That's the technique of the eugenicists.
I remember this now as you're mentioning it. This is back during the Bush administration years in the United States. And there was a debate over what to do about certain stem cell lines and whether to use them. There was a Blue Ribbon Presidential Commission appointed. They eventually recommended, if memory serves, that we could use existing lines for research purposes but couldn't create others. And there was some argument over that, but all right. So there we had it. There was some interesting polling done at the time. The way people came down on the question depended almost entirely on the way the question was phrased.
Yes.
So you asked someone, are you in favor of creating human embryos so that you could experiment with them and then destroy them? And that's horrible. That's atrocious. But if you ask them, well, how about therapeutic cloning? Oh, we're all for that.
Yes.
But it's
yes.
the same thing.
Absolutely.
One of the reasons that Chesterton was so adamant about calling a spade a spade was precisely because he understood, and there's quite a good bit of evidence that he himself was susceptible to this tendency in our nature to want to sugarcoat things.
Yeah.
And to be taken in by softer language.
Well, you know, I think to recall your Ciceronian reference, Chris, I think I'm not sure whether the passage that you were reading last night was the passage in which Cicero says that that which was once a vice has now become a custom. And that's essentially, the way in which this has operated, that something which was once taboo, something which was once unspeakable, has become so familiar to us that it is customary and indeed virtuous. And that's exactly the kind of tendency that Chesterton was anxious about. And as Father said, he saw what was not visible to others, but is now visible to us. So I think what we can draw from this is a need for constant vigilance, a need not to be seduced by the charms of soft language. And we need a kind of moral realism. I suppose in a way it's a distinction between a kind of realist understanding of things and a nominalist smallest understanding of things that somehow or other there is a reality which is not going to be changed by the words that are used, as opposed to those who would see that language itself constitutes reality, and we can make a thing different by calling it by a different name. You know, the reality is that in less fastidious times, what we have is a kind of a soft eugenics, whereby once again distinctions are made between worthy kinds of human life and unworthy kinds of human life. What we have, and what the church has always provided, and what natural law provides, is a set of principles. Get your principles right. If we don't have a clearly defined set of principles, and as Father says, a clearly defined anthropology which recognizes the dignity of every human being, then we will simply fall into utilitarianism of one sort or another. And the question will not be, how do we preserve human dignity? The question will be, how do we maximize human happiness, however understood?
Also, it's good to recognize that the eugenics movement always makes use of, how can I put it, something which is basically good. So, for example, it's now, I understand, I have one of my brothers deals with is a gynecologist, but he tells me, and I've heard elsewhere, that it's now possible to deal with illnesses of a child before it's born. Mm-hmm. So that technique of being able to identify something which is wrong and remedying it is in itself a very good thing. But as with the identifying the Down's child, the unfortunate thing is we do know that this is used chiefly in order to identify, in order to kill. So something which could be good is being misused. We always welcome, I think, truth and knowledge are a good thing, but they're dangerous things as well in a bad age.
Yes, if we have well-formed moral sensibilities, we can do wonderful things. If not, we can do terrible things.
And how about the sophistication of our moral tradition? I suppose this is a matter of education. I was thinking of what we call the principle of double effect. The question would be, if a woman, for example, had a heart condition which was threatening her life, would it be possible to deal with the heart condition even though an unintended effect of the treatment might be the harm it would be done to her unborn child? And I think good moralists would say that you can do that good thing, dealing mm-hmm. with her heart problem, even though an unintended, unfortunate thing might happen, unintended, notice, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. By doing the good thing. That's the double effect principle. It's a little subtle, but it's quite different from seeking the life, as Chesterton said, Herod did, seeking the life of the child in order to destroy him. And by the way, on that point, Chesterton is never far from his religious faith, and he saw the eugenics movement as a reenactment of the one gospel story. Here was Herod again, seeking the massacre of the innocents.
Chesterton, though, this is in the teens. This is mm-hmm. right about the right before the outbreak the First World War. So there is this enormous, not to editorialize too much, but I think it's fair at this point, 100 years later, to describe that people were giddy, were almost drunk with enthusiasm for the inexorable march of scientific progress and its ability to better our lives. And there wasn't the trauma of the war yet. And Chesterton, I don't think he was Catholic yet at the time.
He wasn't, no.
But he is working out of a culturally, you know, we talk about cultural Christianity. Is this, you know, it's a dirty word now. Mm-hmm. But of course, people have to have a culture. And right. if it's not going to be Christian, it's going to be pagan. So right. He was writing to convince a people that wasn't far enough removed from its own cultural presuppositions to have been completely inured to reason.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking for myself, I'm not entirely sure that that situation obtains in our day.
Mm-hmm. What happened in 1913 was enormously significant in a way. Because what we see is a scientific consensus being challenged. And that scientific consensus was that better breeding was possible, and not only possible, but desirable, and not only desirable, but scientifically and objectively true. It took a great deal of intellectual courage on Chesterton's part to say, no, what you claim to be science, in fact, is not science. What you claim to be objectively demonstrated by the laws of genetics is not only not objectively demonstrated by the laws of genetics, but is not, in fact, in any remotely plausible sense, scientific at all. Why? Because heredity does exist, he says. What we know about heredity is that it does exist. It does exist. I mean, we are children of parents. It is subtle, and it is not reducible to one chemically analyzable thing. So Chesterton was not denying the reality of genetics. He was saying that as a scientific proposition, eugenics fails. It's not only morally objectionable, but it is scientifically objectionable because it doesn't actually pass the test of what science is. So in that respect, Chesterton showed enormous intellectual courage because, this eugenics movement, as Father said, had a huge, popular appeal among opinion formers. I mean, the eugenics conference that took place in London had, 500 or so delegates. It still took a degree, I think, of intellectual courage to point to the scientific inadequacies of eugenics. And then, as you say, Chris, he is drawing upon, a culture which is, if not residually Christian, it's certainly in some respects more Christian than British culture today, which is so residual as to be vestigially and disappearingly Christian. And Chesterton was able, through just a kind of a powerful statement of human freedom, to resist this movement. I mean, what was so offensive to Chesterton about eugenics wasn't simply that it was bad science, but that it was deeply illiberal and that it required, the exercise of an enormously coercive state in order to succeed.
He was very, very good at this sort of thing, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Where, first of all, he wouldn't have preached to the scientists. He wouldn't have told them their business. He was a journalist.
That's right.
Knew this. In fact, he very often, I say, because sometimes you will hear Chesterton praised as this, this soaringly erudite intellectual and he was a journalist and he was very conscious of it. And I think he would be appalled to hear himself described in those terms. But that was fine. And he understood something of which perhaps we haven't as firm a hold, any of us in our day, as we might, which is that the scientist, journalist, philosopher, thinker, with regard to the things of the city, there are no special questions.
Exactly.
And so he was able to speak to problems that were interesting, what we used to call the public wheel.
Yes, yes.
And to a public, getting back to the cultural point, that would not be offended itself to hear and to learn or to be reminded
yes.
of the fact that you can't have your cake and eat it too.
Right.
I was going to say, too, a point about Chesterton's wisdom, and connected again with a note of prophecy, Chesterton always saw that the home of scientific materialism in his day and in the future was irreligious Germany. That was the center of, I noticed when he wrote his books, published his book, as you say, Dermot, it was written, a good deal of it was written before the First War. But Chesterton said in his preface to Eugenics and Other Evil, it was finally published in 1922, that he had hoped that the book was unnecessary when the war came along. He thought that the war with Germany had discredited eugenics, because here was the country, all the liberal elite were praising, and then they had to go to war with Prussianism, with Germany, and he felt that surely made his attack on eugenics unnecessary. But he said, you know, human memory is so short that within a very short while, of course, it was back again. It keeps on coming back. And so it is back again. We thought, as I say, the Nazis would have discredited it. And they did for a while, but under another name. Here it is again. So, as Chesterton said in The Ballad of the White Horse, the Christian people never completely win their battles. It's like King Alfred dealing with the Danish invasion. They come back again, now using ink and pen rather than swords, using the media, and that to poison the public mind by soft words which disguise ugly realities.
Chesterton was not yet a Catholic in 1913 when he began this crusade, if I could put it that way, against eugenics. He was certainly a man of Catholic sensibilities. The England to which he was writing had a restored hierarchy at that point for just a little over a half century. And yet he was able, by using publicly available arguments, to reach people and to change minds. That is something, and on the whole, I'm very pleased with the this new Catholic militancy, right?
Mm-hmm.
But very often you'll hear people say things like, you know, as Catholics, we believe that life begins at conception. He'd think that quite beside the point.
Yeah, it's a kind of a category mistake. It's simply a bad philosophical position. It's not a good argument. It's not a good argument in itself. It is not a good argument rhetorically because it's frankly not going to persuade people who don't think that.
It's not a sectarian issue at all.
If we did need access to supernatural revelation in order to know that life begins at conception, then the pro-abortion people would have a point.
They certainly would. But, you know, I mean, you make a very important point, Chris. The point that you were making a few moments ago about Chesterton the journalist. Because there is no distinction between the journalist, the philosopher, the scientist, and so on in the public wheel. And what we see with Chesterton is a man who respected the intelligence of his audience, who made arguments knowing that he had an audience intelligent enough to understand those arguments. And what was that audience? That audience was ordinary people. Ordinary people, not speaking to the specialist, not speaking to the scientist, but speaking to the ordinary man. And Chesterton had this enormous respect for the ordinary person, as he said, you know, seeing the Christ in the ordinary person. I reverence the ordinary man. What I think the challenge for us today is to reverence in the same way the intellect of ordinary people and to expose the agenda of the new eugenicists. And it cannot survive exposure.
And another point I think that we could, another thing we could learn from Chesterton is that you should combine in our battle against the new eugenicists, we should imitate Chesterton's ability to combine humor with his seriousness. What these people cannot stand is to be laughed at. They're dupes often, people who do evil, but they're also absurd. And Chesterton through his humor, he combined deep seriousness with a wonderful sense of humor. And the most effective way of destroying evil, in a way, is to teach people to laugh at it. And Chesterton taught us that, that these people, among other things, are ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And Chesterton held his audience because he was so delightful. And he was our Chesterton. And he had, I always like to quote Charles Williams' comment about Chesterton, that in the end, Chesterton had only really two friends. But his two friends were God and the people. And his two friends, as Williams said, were voiceless and unarmed. And Chesterton said, "I shall be your voice. I shall be your weapon." So he articulated, he spoke for God, and he spoke for the inarticulate, silent people, as he called them, who didn't have a voice. He was their tribune. And he spoke for the poor, who were the first victims of the eugenics movement, because the people who passed that bad legislation did not mean it to be applied to their children. And Chesterton said, if he was an eugenicist, that's the first group he would be concerned with.
It's a very good point, and one that I forget to make too frequently in conversations about these sorts of things, that the proponents of eugenics, whether, you know, regardless of what side of the Atlantic you were on, were not interested in limiting the fertility of white Protestant upper middle class women. You know, this were very, very much aimed at the poor, the immigrant.
Yeah, and I mean, this is so important because once again, we can see the recreation in our own time of the eugenicism which Chesterton opposed. I mean, so that, for example, at the Cairo Conference in 1994, you know, you have very explicitly what the historian Matthew Connolly calls, the use of population control as the, as he calls it, the unfinished business of imperialism. If you cannot control territory, you control populations. And that's exactly what you saw in Cairo in 1994. So what we do is we make available to those lesser breeds who do not know the law, methods of contraception and self-sterilization, which will keep them out of our lives, so to speak.
Another point about the Cairo conference worth noting is that in Cairo, we found one of our great allies was Islam. The pro-life people found that Muslims were completely in agreement with them, so that at Cairo, an alliance was mm-hmm. struck between the Holy See and the Muslims, whereas the spokesmen for Western governments were entirely eugenicists.
Well, and one of the reasons for that was that within Islam, cultural Islam and Islam as a civilizational project, the idea that sexual congress is for getting children
yes.
has not been somehow turned into an anachronistic atavistic absurdity.
That's right.
Now, once that happens, and here I'd like to bring in one of the Chesterton Review's favorite subjects, C.S. Lewis, who deals with this in several different places, but perhaps nowhere more at once entertainingly and chillingly than in the third book of the Space Trilogy, That Hideous Strength, when you're introduced. I won't get into it. It'll be too much inside baseball. But basically, he addresses the idea that, well, if we eliminate or if we separate the idea of sex for pleasure from the idea of sex for procreation, what we end up with is people who are bored with it and don't know why they're doing it.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But the real difficulty is that the violence that one must do to reason in order to keep and maintain that separation is such that, well, not to put too fine a point on it, you have to keep people from being able to think.
Yeah.
And also, by the way, that hideous strength, a companion work to it was Lewis's The Abolition of Man, that Durham University lecture in which he pointed out that the natural alliance was all those who believed, what did he use the Chinese phrase, the Tao, an objective moral order, as opposed to the moral relativists who thought that all morality was simply a projection of your subjective thinking. And Lewis, along with Chesterton, wanted to act, and all like good scientists, that you couldn't have my religion or my philosophy. It was supposed to fit the universe. And Chesterton said that this is I accept the universe. What was it? By God, you'd better.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at the abolition of man, what Lewis is saying is that what we now have in the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment is essentially a new kind of magic. And that new kind of magic is different from the old kind of magic in that it seems to work. But the point is that it is a form of magic which ultimately aims at the control of human beings and, in this case, the elimination of human beings.
That's right. They didn't object. They didn't object, as he pointed out, that hideous strength. He saw you could have an alliance between black magic and scientists if all you're concerned with is effectiveness.
That's right.
And remember Chesterton's comment, which horrified respectable opinion before the First World War, when he said, as for the people who ran England and the British Empire, he said, the best of them are agnostics and the worst of them are devil worshippers.
Not one for mincing words. but let's end on this point, which is one that comes to mind just thinking about Lewis and Chesterton together. I don't think they knew each other.
No.
But Lewis certainly respected his power as a writer. Chesterton became Catholic and Lewis didn't. Both great Christian writers. Charles Williams, you mentioned earlier, this was some tension there. This is a period in which there's an enormous flourishing, a mini renaissance of Christianity. Some people came all the way in to communion with Rome, other people didn't. What was it that Chesterton saw in the Catholic Church that, made so thoroughly conventional a man attracted by it? And how did he sell it, if I could put it that way?
Well, in his autobiography, he puts it this way. He said the short answer of why he became a Catholic, he who was a Catholic in his thinking long before he came into full communion with the Church, he said the short answer was only the Catholic Church could deal practically with sin. Chesterton said he became a Catholic because he wanted to have, he, such an innocent person, wanted to have his sins forgiven. It was the sacrament of penance. And remember, the day he became a Catholic, he wrote a wonderful poem called The Convert, in which he puts it this way. He said he compared modern thinkers to people who are mining for gold, you know, sifting the sand. But he said the kind of the way they do it is strange. They keep the sand and let the gold dust go free. And then he said at the end of the poem, wonderful words, he said, but all of this is less than dust to me because my name is Lazarus and I live. It was a resurrection from the dead. He wanted the church that could deal with, he said, that his own story should end happily, that his dreams of evil and dirt would end well. He wrote to Ronald Knox before his conversion and said, I quite approve of what a big fat man does, giving talks on platforms and writing books. I approve of it, but that's not me. He said, I'm someone they don't know, and I have my inner story, and only the church is capable of bringing that story to a happy ending.
You've been listening to Father Ian Boyd and Professor Dermot Quinn of Seton Hall University. They were speaking with me, Chris Altieri.
You're listening to Vatican Radio.